on fortunes been left to go to rack and ruin. Anyway, I'll make a tape of Gowick someday, what it was originally. Anyway, Wendy was a, as I say, a little dinghy with a big center board and a single sail. She was carvel built. My word, could she skim through the water, just like a cormorant. She was a very sound little boat, as I said before, carvel built. Double needed every thwart for strength. And apart from that, she had a couple of greenheart bilge keels, or as we used to call them, rolling chocks, which gave her added stability. The forward thwart in which the mast was stepped was solid right through to the bow, which gave a good little storage space underneath. In this, there was a light kedge anchor and also a sea anchor, or a drogue as we called them then, while in the stern sheets, two life jackets were stowed. Thank goodness they were never had to be used in any emergency. It was a pair of sculls, of course, because we rowed out from the beach till we had enough water to drop the centre board, while underneath the thwarts was lashed a spare scull. That was always done by even by the boatmen who ran their boats for pleasure off Gowick Beach. There was always three oars in the boat because, you know, Vista was quite apt to lose one or break one, and then there was always the one underneath to get back on. Thinking back for a minute or two on those pleasure boats on Gowick Beach, there was three boatmen there. They had about 15 rowing boats between them, and they made a good living, so you can guess then how many people came down to Gowick in a day in the summertime. Anyway, these pleasure boats, I'm just trying to think on them. You know, I go back on these memories and I've been trying to think on the names of them. I don't think I can name them all, but I think I can name a few. There was the Iris, the Evelyn, the Queenie, the Maggie, Fanny, the Spider, the Duke, the Duchess, the Sea Lark, the Sea Spray, and I don't think I can think of any more. I know that's not 15, but that's just by the way in passing. Well, getting back to Wendy again. As I said, the mast was stepped in the forward thwart, and the helo dropped into a square socket mounted on the keel. Through this, our bolt with a wing nut arm was passed right through the socket and the mast to prevent it being jerked out by any sudden gust or anything, because there was no forestay or shrouds to it. The halyards were reeved off through a couple of small pulley blocks along the straker to a belaying cleat well within reach of the person at the tiller. And this was very handy because if you want to take a couple of reefs in, you could always slacken the sail away and get the reefs put in without struggling or any pulling or anything like that. Spill the wind out of the sail and you get them in quite easy. However, Mr. Callow was a very, very keen fisherman, just for sport, mind you, not for business or anything like that. And he had some of the most wonderful tackle I've ever seen in my life at that time. Couple of beautiful sea rods with handmade reels with clutches and checks and goodness knows what on them, and I think there must have been quarter mile, maybe half a mile of line on each one. Every known bit of tackle you could wish a fisherman to have. I suppose today it would cost a fortune. It would be a fortune then in those days too, I suppose, really. His gaff was made of polished steel, which had to be cleaned at the end of every trip and a bit of oil put on it, and this gaff was always fastened inboard with a long lanyard to it, because you might slip, you know, or any little accident, and when you were landing the big fish, and the gaff would be gone overboard and would sink, of course, but he wasn't risking losing that. But he never liked using the gaff if he could use the tailor, on account of damaging the gills of the fish. Perhaps I better explain a tailor, because some of you people listening might think it's somebody that makes suits or something. Well, in the first place, it's spelled T-A-I-L-E-R, so it's not the tailor you were thinking of. Well, the simplest way I think of explaining it is a steel spring noose. You open the noose, and when you got the fish alongside the boat, you slipped it along his body over his tail, released the catch at the top, and of course the steel spring sprang into place, and his tail wouldn't come out of it, so you just lifted him inboard without any damage to his head or anything like that, or damage to your own line. That also had to be cleaned and oiled after every trip. Mr. Callow was very meticulous over things like that. Of course, the tailor was no use for the likes of a conger or a skate. It had to be a fish with a fan tail on it. You know, salmon, big cod, big kelleg, anything like that. You didn't use it for small fish like whiting or mackerel or gurnets. But with a big plaice or a big turbot, it was mighty handy to land them, because you could damage them something shocking when you're trying to gaff them. Well, as you may have gathered by now, I used to sail Wendy for Mr. Callow when he went on his fishing trips. He always brought a good lunch basket with him, and a couple of bottles of beer for himself, and a couple of bottles of ginger beer for me. I think I'd be about 10 then, but my grandpa had been teaching me to sail since I was about 8, so although I was only a kid, I was quite an expert to handle a small boat like that. Just deviating again for a moment or two. Well, I'm bad to do that, I know, but when you've no script and these thoughts come back to you, if you don't put them down at the time, they're forgotten again. Think of me grandfather's training in sailing. Always his maxim was safety first. He used to say, the sea's too big to whip, so you go along with it. I suppose had he been alive today, he'd have said, if you can't beat them, join them. But that was always his maxim, safety. And it was a good maxim too, when you come to look back on it. You know, today, a person who's never been on anything more than maybe the Wallasey ferries can go to a boat yard and buy anything from a dinghy to a cabin cruiser, depending on what money he's got, and put to sea in it. I know there's sailing courses at lots of places, but they're not compulsory. But in my opinion, an amateur buying a boat should be made to go through the same sort of drill as a man driving a car. You can't go on the road with a motor car today without having passed a driving test, and I think the same should apply to amateur yachtsmen or boatmen. Because you often hear of a tragedy with a family in a dinghy or a catamaran or something like that. You know, it should be made compulsory. It's just as hard to drive on the sea as it is to drive on the road. In fact, I think it's harder at times. Must be thousands of good men around our coastlines, expert yachtsmen, lifeboat coxswains, lifeboat men, who'd be well qualified to act as examiners and instructors for these amateurs. And in my very humble opinion, which nobody ever takes any notes of, I think it could be instrumental in saving life in the finish. Well, now to get back to Wendy again. Despite the fact she didn't carry a jib, it was amazing how close to the wind you could sail her. And on many a long haul, say to Canary or anything with a fair wind, it was a joy to sail that boat. She could fairly skip along. Well, now regards to the fishing we did. It was usually at the weekends when the glen was quiet, because there was no Sunday open in those days or anything for pubs. And usually Saturday afternoon or Sunday I went fishing with Mr. Callow, which didn't interfere with me going out with my grandfather, you see. One of Mr. Callow's favourite trips was to Canay, in the hope of picking up a couple of salmon, which he usually did too. We always tried to get there on the beginning of a flood tide when the salmon were going into the estuary to feed. Well, if we had a fair wind, we could belt along there in no time. And as he was a very portly gentleman, he sat on the middle thwart on the weather side and tried for a cod on the way there. But if we had to beat up against the wind in short tacks, well, he usually just sat back and popped from weather side when we tacked over to the other weather side. And as I say, he was a portly gentleman and he was good ballast. He usually smoked a few cigarettes on the way there, and very often he gave me one too, threatened me with all kinds of dire penalties if I told anybody. I remember it so well, there were Gold Flake, a cigarette you hardly ever see now, and that's not a commercial either. Well, we'd get to Canay and out would come the big sea rod and a spinner, light spinner, or maybe a wet fly sometimes. But when he got a couple of salmon, if they were good ones, he was quite content. He didn't want any more. He took them home, of course. Well, I'm saying home, to Gower Glen Hotel, because it was residential then, and fresh salmon on the menu was quite a big attraction. If we'd happened to pick up a cod or a couple of cod on the way there, well, of course, they went up too, because they could be served in the cafe, which was attached to the Glen Hotel for visitors, and the thriving business it did. If we were lucky and picked up a couple of salmon pretty early, we'd go off to sea then, well out really, to the mackerel grounds. And he'd put on his mackerel tackle on his rod, and well, the mackerel tackle was a 6 pound weight to start with, because they swim pretty low, and a long cast. Well, he'd pick up a dozen or maybe 18 mackerel, maybe a couple of gurnets. He didn't want these, but there was a few old people in the village, and I'd be told to distribute them to them on the way home. You know, a bit of fresh fish is nice for an old person. He was very generous that way. And always at the end of the trip, there was a couple of bob or half a crown, or I should say 10 pence or 12 and a half pence for me. And by gum, that was very useful to a youngster my age, you know. Of course, we didn't always go out on the sail, you know. If we were going flat fishing, well, the masts and sails and rudder were all unshipped and left behind in the boathouse. And I rode Wendy out to all the flat fishing grounds. Mind, there was some grand flat fish around Gawick and Laxey those days. But now they tell me these foreign trawlers come in at night, no lights, big beam trawlers, and they sweep the bays from end to end, taking everything in their stride, small mesh nets and all. It should not be allowed. It's not supposed to be allowed, but they do it in the dark. Well, I'd row Wendy out, as I said, out round Governor Silver Point. Then we'd head toward Laxey until we could see the old powder house on Clay Head. That was a big solid stone structure where dynamite, gelignite, etc. was stored by the merchants in town that sold it, miles away from anywhere. I believe it's been demolished now, so that's another landmark gone. Well, when we got the powder house in sight, we turned sharp out to sea until we could see the spires of Lonnon Church, and then we dropped the kedge anchor with a good amount of scope taut so Wendy could swing round in a very wide arc as the tide ebbed or flowed. Well, his bottom fishing tackle was usually rather heavy weight. I don't know what the weight would be, probably about 2 or 3 pound. And four paternosters all come out from the cast with a hook on each bait. And then he settled down to fish on the bottom, and I usually settled down up in the bows with a Nelson Lee or a Sexton Blake or a Magnet or a Gem. It was rather boring. I didn't enjoy as much as sailing, but I was getting paid for it, of course, so that made all the difference. A lot of good fish were caught on these fishing grounds, place, skate, occasionally a turbot, very occasionally lemon sole, but Mr. Keller always took the place and any turbot he got home for the menu for his residence in the hotel. And I suppose it must be very attractive to have fresh place on your menu right out of the sea. The skate he never wanted. I don't know, he didn't seem to like them. Well, not an awful lot of people do like skate, but he had a friend who lived up on the Lurgy, Mr. Jackson, and I was often sent up there with one if we got a decent one. We also caught quite an abundance of dabs, flounders and whiting, but of course these he didn't want either, and I used to distribute them to the elderly people of the village on my way home. Occasionally, as I said, we picked up a lemon sole. The lemon sole never went on the menu, of course. Mr. and Mrs. Callow ate that themselves, and you can't blame them, because the lemon sole is the finest tasting fish in the whole of the Seven Seas. Picked up the odd turbot now and again too, but the big day was the day we got the 10-pounder. That was the proudest day of his life, and I'm sure he wouldn't have changed places with King George V that day. My word, what a fight he had with that fish. It must have taken an hour or an hour and a half to get that fish. He played it and played it, and he'd be winding in, and the line would go whizzing out again as the clutch took over. And I was standing by with the tail line off about best part of an hour before we got him alongside. But we got him inboard, and then it was nothing but up anchor and head for home. He had a photograph it taken too before it was ever eaten, just to prove in the bar that it wasn't the one that got away. Another type of fishing we used to do was around the rocks, close inshore, 80, 100 yards off the shore in the very deep water. Out round from the stall point, out round to Clay Head and out round by the Clet. Now the fish in there were pretty useless. Some people ate them, but I don't think many people did. He liked to get a conger occasionally. Well, the conger was good for eating. The people used to dry them for the winter and cut them off like pieces of stockfish. But we used to get a lot of bolan. I can't think what the English name is for bolan now. And blarkin, which are cold fish. Rock salmon, which to us were called dogfish, and nobody ever ate them. But he got a lot of sport out of this, especially when he got a big conger on and played him for an hour or so. Then when we got him inboard, of course, there was a small axe always kept in the boat to split the head of him with, because that's the only way you could kill a conger. And even then, afterwards, when I chopped him up sometimes for lobster pot bait for the salt barrel for my grandfather, the pieces would still be jumping after they were cut into about 6-inch pieces. This kind of fishing was a rowing job for me, not a sailing one, but just rowing very gently, you know, a pair of sculls. But one had to be careful around there because there was a big tide rip on Clay Head, and it could be dangerous at times if you didn't know it. When the young flood met the old ebb, it was quite a rip on that point, but we always watched it and were very careful over it. The bolan was a good fighting fish too. He'd give Mr. Carroll quite a bit of sport, but it was no use for anything but lobster pot bait. And we chopped them up and put them in the salt tub. But before I finish the Wendy saga, I must tell you this little bit. In the throat of the bolan, there's a bone. It's about a quarter of an inch thick. And it's shaped like a triangle. But just imagine a triangle with concave sides to it. Pretty pretty little thing, really. And in the centre of all this, they're like little blobs that look like mother of pearl when they're polished up. I don't know what the biological use of it is in the bolan throat, but they were regarded as a lucky charm. Well, when I split the bolans up, I used to take these out and take them home, wash them, polish them, and I've sold many a one to a Gullible Vista for a shilling or two, you know. I had an eye to the main chance even at that age. Well, that's about the end of my story about Wendy, so now we'll carry on with a few yarns about the Mona. Well, Mona, as I said before, is a 16-foot open boat, clinker built. Very strong boat. Heavy ribbed, heavy green hard keel, and quite a heavy boat to handle, especially pulling up the beach after fishing. But of course we had a winch for that. Not a power-driven one, just a hand winch, but one man could heave her up with another man steadying her by the gunwale as she came up. Well, she was used for fishing all through World War I by my grandfather. She had provision for 8 oars if necessary, 4 sets of rollocks down each gunwale, but of course these were never used. All we ever used on it was a couple of 12-foot sweeps and me probably up in the bow thwart with a pair of sculls. And as I say, she was used for fishing, but commercially, not for sport like Mr. Callow. That was my grandfather's living. We could step a mast in the midship thwart as well and use a big lug sail. But the only trouble with this was we had to load about 300 or 400 weight of pig iron ballast into her before we left the beach. Well, this was quite a big job really, but when you were sailing long haul to Canay, it saved a lot of trouble with oars and all, you know, even round a groudle, as long as you had a fair wind. She wasn't sprightly sailing, but not like Wendy, of course, but with a fair wind, she could make 3 or 4 knots. The pig iron ballast was always loaded into her well below high water mark. They'd pull her down the beach, well below high water mark, as I say, and then load the ballast into her, and then wait for the tide to float her. It was easier than trying to load it and then pull it down into the water. But as I say, on a long haul, the old lug sail was all right, but she wouldn't sail very close to the wind or anything like that. But if we were going out to the mackerel grounds too, it saved a lot of rowing, and sometimes if you had the breeze right, you could use the lug sail and fish mackerel at the same time. There's not much more to tell you about the boat herself, except that she carried all the usual gear, anchor and drogue, axe, gaffs, all the usual things appertaining to fishing. So now we'll go on with the fishing that we did. I'll start with the salmon fishing, which we always did at Canay. Now, unlike Mr. Callow, we didn't go in on the start of the flood tide. We went in at the full flood, just before the ebb started on the slack water, and then we netted the mouth of the river, the estuary, right across. And of course, as the salmon came down, they were caught in the net. The net, if I remember rightly, was 2-inch mesh, so as the small stuff could slip through. And it was only the prime fish we took, actually. None of this continental stuff picking everything up. Well, it was about 10 foot wide, I think, 10 to 12 foot wide. And I couldn't for the life of me remember the length of it, but it was a long, long net. On the bottom edge, the edge that sank, there was a manila rope bound, of course, and also on the top edge, but on the bottom edge, there was a weight every fathom. This weight was a piece of lead water pipe, which was very, very cheap those days, you know. Just split and then clinched around the rope, or thou, as the Manx fishermen called it, along the bottom edge. On the top edge, every fathom, there was a small cork float. And at the end, there was a 70-pound weight on the bottom edge, and a buoy on the top edge, of course. Now, this net had to be very carefully prepared before you left the beach. It was put in layers on a hand barrow, or a net barrow, as we called it, which fit across the stern sheets of the boat. Because when you were shooting this net, if it fouled on the way out, it was an awful job then to get it reset again, because it was wet, you see, and it was heavy enough as it was. But as I say, it was very carefully prepared before we left the beach, and I never remember a fouled net yet, not with salmon nets anyway. Well, we'd shoot the net, and then we'd go to sea, probably out to the mackerel grounds or maybe out to lift the cod lines. And at about 3/4 ebb, we'd come back in. Well, the net had to be lifted very carefully. From one end you started, with the boat going astern, just by oars, of course. And you lifted the bottom weight first, till you had the two of them, the bottom weight and the buoy, or mollig, as the Manx people called it, together, just like a folded sheet, and the net was brought in very carefully over the stern. In the meantime, the batter had been chucked up in the bower of the road, and the salmon boxes were prepared, big fish boxes, lined with fern on the bottom, and as the salmon came in, they were just put carefully in the boxes so as they wouldn't damage themselves. Well, it was a heavy job, and you took a lot of water inboard when you were pulling the net in, of course. And once you got the net inboard, well, you let it drain a bit and then you lift the scottage and you start to bail, because you usually had 50 and 20 bucks of water in the boat. And of course you're all pretty wet too, although we wore oilskin pants, but my grandfather never allowed sea boots at sea. That was one of his safety maxims as well. You could wear them on the beach and we were pottering about in the shallows and getting the boat loaded, but once you got to sea, they had to come off. Because you know, if a fellow went overboard with sea boots on, well, that was his lot, he'd be gone. A dozen or so prime salmon, you know, were a good haul, because even those days they were pricey, but sometimes we got quite a few more. But a salmon that had spawned, anything like that, went straight back in the sea again. They had to be prime fish. Well, when we got back to the beach, of course, they were in their boxes packed, ferns packed on top of them and lids put on, all ready for delivery to Clukes's of Duke Street in Douglas, who were then the premier fish merchants of the island. Unfortunately, they're no longer there. Progress, I suppose. But no matter what time we got back to the beach, the net had to be unloaded out of the boat, and spread on the beach to dry, well above high water mark, of course. And if we got back in daylight, of course, net would be dry in like a half an hour, and then we'd have to start to overhaul it, take out a piece of seaweed that were in it, because they would snag the net going out again. Carry a net needle with you, loaded with twine, and if a mesh had gone, that had to be repaired. And well, when the net was dry and all tidied up again, the net batter was brought, and it was packed on, layered on, ready for the next time you went to the salmon. All done very carefully, and then a tarpaulin sheet lashed down over it, so there was no delay next time you went to sea. Well, I think that deals with the salmon fishing. Now, there was also the lobster pots. That was another very big job. These pots were what you'd call now the old-fashioned type, made of willow, or sallies as we called them. Handmade, of course, by my grandfather during the winter. He made all his own gear, nets, pots and everything. That was his job during the winter, when there was no fishing on. But I'll describe the making of the nets and the pots later on the tape, if I've got enough room on the tape. So, we ran a bar of, well, they called it a bar, that was a number of pots, of 30 pots. And they extended from just the other side of the stall point, right round almost to Growdle. Not very far from the rocks, but in very deep water. Oh, 20, 30 fathoms in some places. Well, in the bottom of these pots, there was about 70 pound of ballast. These were small concrete blocks, two of them in each pot, with a groove round them and to hold a rope, and they were lashed to the bottom of the pot. And the rope, or thow as we called it, was heavy for about 10 fathoms and then lighter after that, because you see, there was not much weight in the pot when you were hauling it up. At the end of the light thow, of course, there was a very, very big cork float with quite a big stick through it. A big sally, actually, it was, a thick one. And it floated upright and you had a chance of seeing it. Now, on a flood tide at high water, the tide was that strong it would run these corks under, you see. So, of course, we had to go on the ebb tide in the slack water. Well, as I say, the pot wasn't very heavy till it got near the surface. The nearer the surface it got, the heavier it got. And lifting it inboard was quite a heavy job. Now, during World War I, help for crewing was very hard to come by because most of the young men in the village were away at the army. But my grandfather, although he had a family of 10 himself, he had taken a lad out of the children's home, a boy named Albert. He was about 7 years older than me, and of course he was almost a man, but yet he was too young to join the army. Well, Albert and I and my grandfather very often managed ourselves. Of course, there was sometimes when I was at school, when then my auntie, another strong girl, she'd be about 20. She used to put a pair of oilskin pants on and go out and give a hand with the lobster pots. Well, the method, we'd pick up the first pot. Well, in between the next pot, there'd probably be, 100 yards. My grandfather would get the lobsters out, and the first thing he had to do was tie the claws of them because they'd tear each other to bits. And besides that, they could take your finger off very nearly. Well, while he was doing that, I'd be sculling the mooner toward the next pot, and Albert would be baiting the pot we'd already lifted. Well, as soon as we lifted the second pot, we dropped the one we'd lifted to start with back in its place, of course, and so on like that right through till we got to the end of the bar of pots. Well, number 30, I think it was about 30 we ran, number 30, we'd take back with us and drop it in the place where we'd originally picked up number one, so no time was lost in between the pots. Well, all this sounds very easy when you hear it on tape, but believe me, it was hard going a lot of the time, because we had to work with the tides. Sometimes you'd be lifting the pots at 3 o'clock in the morning, other times you'd be lifting them at 10 o'clock at night, and when there was a heavy sea or a lump of a sea run or a big swell, you know, it was not as easy as it sounds. And of course, there was a lot of preparation before you left the beach. The bait had to be got ready. This was usually old chopped cod heads, which we got from Glucks's. They were sent down the hamper every week. When the lobster hamper was sent back, it was packed with cod heads. These all would be split and salted and put down in the barrel. And other fish, as I said before, previously, other fish were split up and put in the salt barrel. Well, we had to take bait out for each pot. And they were fastened to a little bit of cane, which was laced in between the sullies of the pot. That's the end of this side, I think. So would you be kind enough to turn the tape over to track 2, please?